I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Teenagers want their parents to talk with them about sex. That's what the research says. And parents mostly shy away from that conversation, or they have the talk and are glad to be done with it. While we have made great strides tackling other complicated issues, we're still pretty backward when it comes to comprehensive sexuality education. About half of the states mandate sex ed, although not Pennsylvania, and what is taught can run the gamut, according to the Guttmacher Institute. Our guest, Al Vernacchio, teaches and talks with students about sex and all the values and expressions and hopes and fears that come with it at Friends Central School in Wynwood, which is just outside of Philadelphia. He says that even if adults don't talk with young people about sex, they learn about it anyway, as they always have, and now increasingly online, where pornography is just a click away. He's the author of For Goodness Sex, and he joins us on Radio Times to talk about what children and teenagers want to know. Al Vernacchio, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You know, reading your book and thinking about this topic, I was thrown back to my years in school, trying to remember the kind of sex education that I had. It was either a joke, or it was full of misinformation, or it was nothing. What a most, and we've got mostly adults listening to us. Is that pretty true for most adults, including yourself?
It's absolutely typical. Most of us got either pretty bad sexuality education or none at all. A lot of us got basic anatomy lessons with no sense of how you have conversations about sex or how you negotiate. And a lot of us got very fear-based information.
Just say no.
Just say no.
Because if you say yes, you're going to be in big trouble.
That's right.
You want a different tack. I mean, you have kind of built your career around doing something very different about sexuality education. Help us understand that.
Sure. The basic premise to my work is to look at our sexuality as a force for good. So to see our bodies, our emotional capacities, our relationships as things that can make us live our most authentic lives and actually make the world better than we found it. I have always, because of my training, I've always taught sexuality education through an equity and justice lens. Yeah. So it's really about how can we help young people become their best selves, and by living out honestly and deliberately their sexuality, how can they make the world better?
I'm sure people listening thinking equity and justice is over here. Mm-hmm. What happens in intimate moments between whether they are teenagers or adults is over there. What's the connection?
Well, I would even challenge that premise, because the thinking that sexuality or intimate moments are isolated from the rest of our life is actually one of the big misstatements that I try to challenge in my work, because our sexuality has to be integrated into our whole lives. And so if we isolate it into one area or one moment or one time in our life, we are not learning how to be full, complete, because we take our bodies everywhere we go. We take our emotions everywhere we go. So we have to be able to have a more integrated approach than a more isolationist approach.
So what happens, quote unquote, out there affects what happens with all of us.
Absolutely. As we walk through the day, we're constantly getting messages about our bodies, our gender, our sexual orientation, and we can't ignore those. And how do we integrate those into the decisions that we make? How do they shape the values that we have? How do they inform us or misinform us?
The fact that you're gay and you're out, how does that shape the way you approach sexuality education?
Well, I think as a sexuality educator, it's really important that I can be my authentic self. And being in a school where I can be out, and not the only out teacher, there are many at our school, so kids can actually see that LGBTQ people are not all the same, that we have very different ways of living our lives, we have very different personalities. It just allows them to see us as human, and from that basic point of humanity, we can move forward together. And it also shows them that there's nothing to be afraid of. You know, again, what we know reduces homophobia in general is having a personal experience of knowing somebody who is out as LGBTQ. And so kids, even if we never talk about it, kids who know that I'm gay and that I have a husband and that that's an important part of my life, That helps reduce stigma and misinformation and ultimately homophobia, and they're going to carry that with them out into the world.
Do you think if someone has homophobia that that is a sign that they have issues with sexuality, maybe even their own sexuality?
I mean, I think that it's possible that they've either been misinformed or that they were given or that they're coming from a value system where, you know, same-sex attraction and love and relationships are not okay. I'm not it's not my job to tell somebody that their values are wrong. It's my job to help people understand why they believe what they believe, give them information that can help them understand what they believe, and then it's their decision. People have to make their own decisions about the values. So there are certainly kids in our school and certainly adults who might not think it's so great to have teachers who are as out as I am. I respect that. However, the values of my school are that it's actually fine. And so, you know, it's important that I uphold the values of my institution as well as my own personal values as I do my work.
Let me give out the phone number.
Sure.
And it's 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We are talking about sexuality education, comprehensive sexuality education, something our guest Al Vernacchio does at Friends Central, which is a school just outside of Philadelphia. I do want to talk with you about what you talk to the students about, and we should say, or I should say, you talk to 4 or 5 year olds, nursery school students, and also 12th graders. But let me play a clip from Mean Girls, and this is a sex ed class from that movie, which came out in 2004.
Don't have sex, because you will get pregnant and die. Don't have sex in the missionary position. Don't have sex standing up. Just don't do it. Promise? Okay, everybody take some rubbers.
All right. How do you do it, Al Vernacchio? Obviously, that's not
My approach.
The recommended approach. Go ahead.
Sure. So first of all, I call that the disaster model, you know, the whole if you have sex, you're going to die. And that's not true. And what we're looking for is to help kids develop a healthy sense of sexuality. You know, I've never met a parent who didn't tell me that someday they wanted their kids to have a healthy, satisfying, committed sexual relationship. So that can't happen when you start from, if you do it, you'll die.
Right.
So instead, we start from a place of, you know, what does it mean to have sex? What are the different kinds of sexual expression that people might engage in? What's an appropriate kind of sexual expression for your age and stage? Obviously, that's different for a 3-year-old than an 18-year-old. And then it's about helping kids get the information and practice the skills of communication, the skills of listening, the skills of thinking that help them make good decisions when they come upon them. And it's making decisions in the everyday life that will then carry over into the sexual and intimate situations. We can't pretend that the sexual parts of our lives exist in a vacuum. So, you know, three-year-olds learning how to share with each other.
Well, I was just going to ask you about 3-year-olds. Help
sure.
us understand that.
Sure. So when I was called in last year to the nursery class, the teacher asked me if I could do something to help the kids think about gender equity, which is a big concept for a 3-year-old.
Sure.
So I brought in 2 storybooks, one book about a boy who wanted to be a princess and one book about a girl who didn't want to be a princess. And we read both books together. And then I asked the children, so who gets to be a princess? And they said, anybody who wants to be. And I said, so why should that be the rule? And they said, because that's fair. So there you go. Fairness is a concept 3-year-olds understand. And if we can start to convey a message that fairness extends to boys and girls and what boys and girls are allowed to do and how they can express themselves and what they like, and that what's most important is that you get to express what you like and what you want, and that it doesn't matter so much what body you inhabit. And that was a great lesson.
I mean, it seems what you are saying, and I think it should be underscored, is it's as much about talking about sex or sexuality than it is about, in a sense, naming the parts.
Oh, absolutely. And naming the parts is, I mean, I think that's an essential piece that every parent needs to do with their children when they're very little. I don't really believe in childhood language for body parts. I think it's
call them what they are.
Right, yeah. We tell kids an elbow is an elbow, so there's no reason why we shouldn't call a genital what it is. But that talking about fairness, talking about sharing, talking about asking permission, those are incredibly transferable skills when it comes later in life to negotiating sexual and intimate relationships or encounters.
There was a really interesting piece in the The Washington Post today. A third grade teacher out in a different state, not Pennsylvania, is talking with her students about what is consent and what does consent sound like. And this is for third graders, so they're what, 8 or 9 years old. Mm-hmm. Yes, sure. Yes, please. Of course. Yes, I'll allow that. Okay. I mean, the idea of giving young people.
Right.
Language, words to use.
Yes. And I talk about with kids, little kids and big kids, that when it comes to consent, whenever you're interacting with somebody else's body, property, or reputation, you have to ask consent. And that's a simple question, or that's getting a simple acknowledgement. And so starting with everyday consent and how we practice that, we can then see what feels natural, what feels awkward, where are the places we need to do work. And then when we're talking about sexual consent later on, they've got a basis from which they can draw, and we can even move further in that work.
I'm curious, especially with teenagers, the various definitions of what they think sex is, how they define it for themselves.
Sure. It's really a moving target. It's very hard to pin down a definition. I do think that most kids would say that sexual intercourse, vaginal intercourse, is what having sex is. That's sort of what counts. And one of the
things. Would that be their language, in a sense?
That would be their language, yeah. And so one of the things I do is help unpack that. So if that's what sex is, then look at what that says. That says that two women who are together don't actually ever have sex. That says that people who don't use their genitals, people who might be differently abled or people who might have spinal cord injuries, don't have sex. That means that people who for whatever reason find pleasure in other parts of their body. So, you know, the definition that they have might actually have a whole host of ramifications. And so I want to examine that. And then we, you know, in my upper school class with 11th and 12th graders, we can spend 2 days talking about the definition of having sex.
Yeah.
And not come to any magic conclusion, but just really look at the subtlety of it and understand how our definition impacts the way you're going to see the world and move in the world.
And the idea, we're almost up in a break,
sure.
The idea of enlarging that definition.
Absolutely.
To be as inclusive as it possibly can be.
Absolutely.
We've got calls and comments coming in here on Radio Times. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Al Vernacchio. He is a comprehensive sexuality educator. He also happens to be chair of the English department at Friends Central School, which is in Wynwood, just outside of Philadelphia. And a couple of years ago, he wrote a book for parents called For Goodness Sex, Changing the Way We Talk to Teens About Sexuality, Values, and Health. You've had a sense, a flavor for how he approaches this important topic, and we do want you to join us. Any questions or comments, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. After this short break, we'll talk more about what parents need to know, the language they need to have to talk to their kids about sex and sexuality. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowang talking with Al Vernacchio about comprehensive sexuality education. Let me play a scene from the TV show My So-Called Life. A mom, played by Bess Armstrong, is giving her daughter, trying to give her daughter Angela, played by Claire Danes, the talk.
Now that you and Jordan are...
Oh, my God. Mom, please.
Angela. I can accept that you have a boyfriend.
I don't have a boyfriend.
Fine. A pal. A male pal. Whatever word you want to choose. The point is, I'm your mother, and I don't think you're ready.
Mom, please.
I don't think you're ready. But I have to know if this is what's happening, because I don't think that I can keep
Mom,
you from...
Mom, I beg you to stop.
I need to know that you're using... I remember how this feels. I do, but it's the times that we live in.
Mom, please.
Honey, I know you don't want to think about these things. I know that you think you're invulnerable.
I don't think that. You
have
no idea.
To use some kind of protection if you are going to be...
Mom, I'm not having sex, all right? Really. I'm not even close to an embarrassing degree.
Oh.
Okay.
It's a great scene, I have to say. Al, I began the show by saying children want their parents to talk to them about sex. Clearly, in this scene, she does not want to talk to her mother about sex. Help us understand this dynamic.
Sure. The research does say that kids do want to hear from their parents. Often, though, I think what kids want to hear and what's helpful is not always what parents want to say. So I encourage parents to say things like, have you told your teenager the story of your first kiss, or how you navigated your first broken heart, or how you thought about your first serious relationship. Those are the things that kids are trying to figure out. Now, what I love about...
Not the time you lost your quote-unquote
virginity. No, not at all. And, you know, and if a kid asks a parent that, a parent has every right to say, I'm not comfortable talking about that. Like, that's really not a place I'm ready to go. And maybe they are someday, maybe they're not. But parents have a right to set reasonable limits and boundaries around their own histories and their own behaviors. But I loved when the mom in that clip said, when Claire Danes pushed back and said, he's not my boyfriend. And she gave a lot of other language,
yeah.
A pal, a male pal. So important. I always use the word sweetheart because that's a word
that's so old fashioned and lovely.
You know, it is, but it's not gendered and it doesn't necessarily signify a sexual experience, but it's somebody that is more than a friend. And more than a hookup. And so I think our language really does matter with kids.
Well, that's a TV show. And I'm wondering whether TV shows, movies, music, you know, give parents and their children opportunities to talk about all this stuff.
Absolutely. I always encourage parents to watch what their kids are watching, to listen to the music they're listening to, and not to be a critic or a judge, but if a parent has an honest reaction, it's really important to share that, you know, to say something like, gee, they wound up in bed really quickly. That seems really fast. Or
do you think she really likes him?
Exactly. Or do you think she's having as much pleasure as he has? You know, these are questions that are not about kids' lives directly, but that are covering really important information that kids really need to know and think about and talk about with trusted adults.
Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Stacy from Philadelphia joining our conversation here on Radio Times. And Stacy, go ahead. You're on the air. Do we have her? We will try to get her. All right. There we go. Hi, Stacy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 16-year-old daughter who spent the first couple years of her early adolescence feeling that she was asexual and now, you know, feels like maybe she's demisexual, but really, you know, feels strongly that she doesn't have sexual feelings towards any gender. And I'm wondering, as a parent, how to best talk with her about these feelings, especially if, you know, I obviously respect her orientation, whatever that turns out to be, but I certainly don't want her making choices that are fear-based. So I was just wondering if you had any advice for parents to discuss asexuality or demisexuality.
You're a good mom, Stacy.
Yeah, sure, Stacy. Thanks for that question. It's so great. So today, kids have so many different labels to identify their gender, their sexual and romantic orientations, and that can really make adults' heads swim sometimes because we're not always caught up on all the verbiage. I'm always learning new labels from kids. So what's important is to acknowledge that when a young person announces an identity or an orientation, that we say, thanks for letting me know. I really appreciate you telling me. If you don't know what that means, you ask for clarification. And then know that today, unlike I think when we were teenagers, identities feel a lot more fluid.
Yes,
and kids really feel like they're often transitioning from this place to that place. So I always say to a kid, if that's the label you're putting on yourself today, that's terrific. I acknowledge it. I respect it. Let's see if that's the same label tomorrow. And let's see if that's the same label 6 months down the road, you know? Because what's important is the patterns, not any one moment of identification. And in terms of, I love that you said, Stacy, that you didn't want her to be fear-based. And, you know, people who are asexual aren't necessarily asexual out of fear. They just don't have any real level of sexual desire. And that can be perfectly healthy and perfectly normal. So I do think if you want to ask her, is this identity coming out of some trauma experience or fear experience, fine, but don't assume that it is, because it might just be a very natural place to be for her.
Stacey, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. But it seems that adolescence is a time when young people are experimenting, trying things out, trying out identities, doing things they might regret, but as a way of trying to figure out who they are.
Sure. And I think what good comprehensive sexuality does is help reduce the risks, the risk of something really damaging, either physically or emotionally or psychologically, happening from that experimentation. Experimentation is a normal thing for kids, especially teenagers, to do. So helping kids find parameters for what where the boundaries are around that is really important. Really talking about the influence of alcohol and other substances and how that might impact decisions about sexual activity is really important. Really challenging kids. I talk to my students all the time about, so why is it that we've conflated sex and alcohol so much? Why are we so freaked out that we can't do that sober? And what does that tell us?
You have, I think you still have your question box.
I do.
In your classroom where students can, I guess, anonymously put in the questions that they have.
Yes.
What does that tell us? What do they want to know?
So what's interesting is, I've had a question box in my classroom for as long as I've been doing this. So that's almost 30 years. The questions don't vary all that much.
Really?
Over
30 years?
Yeah. They're all still variations of, am I normal? They're all asking, what's the right time to initiate sex? And they want a day, a date, and a time. And I tell them there is no day, date, and time. That basically my rule is, if you can look somebody in the eye and talk about it calmly and rationally, then you might be ready to do it. And if you can't do that, then maybe you're not ready.
Well, that's an interesting metric for adults as well.
Absolutely.
not just for teenagers. Well, let's talk about pornography.
Sure.
And I should say that Philadelphia Magazine did an interview with you over the summer about kids and pornography. Mm-hmm. And I don't think any of us should be surprised, especially with the internet and cell phones, that
right.
Pornography is literally a click away. How much do you think that is influencing teenagers and how they think about sex?
I think the prevalence and the easy availability of pornography and sexually explicit material is something that's come with the advent of everybody having a smartphone. So I think we have to think of it now as a very normal part of teenagers' right. development. The important thing is to interrupt the harmful messages that kids are going to get if they're looking at that material and are simply going along with the assumptions they provide. So, the fact that bodies don't necessarily really look like that. The fact that once you introduce a camera into a moment, it changes the nature of the moment. The fact that what they're looking at is a constructed, staged scene. They wouldn't come out of the Fast and Furious movies and think that's the way to drive.
It's a movie.
Right. So to come out of pornography and to think, well, that's exactly how people have sex, that needs to be critically examined as well. But we can't shame them for being curious and seeking out. I mean, they want to know what bodies look like. They want to know what people do when they're together sexually. And that's not a great place to go for that, but that's the easiest place right. to go. And so we have to acknowledge that and work with that.
I mean, there is a range. Some of it is really aggressive sex that I think it has nothing to do with that Playboy centerfold that
That's
someone
right.
might have seen a couple of generations ago.
That's right. And I think we have to be really explicit with kids about the fact that violent pornography that involves rape fantasies or things like that that's not okay to be watching, because we know it really does increase people's violent thoughts and attitudes, and it affects their attitudes toward women, so that there are real harmful side effects of that, and we have to make that explicit. And also that's not fair for the people involved in it. And so are we thinking about those people in the scenes as human beings? And are we giving them the same sense of dignity that we would give any other person?
You include something in near the end of your book, Why is Watching Pornography Such a Turn-On? And trying to answer the question that I'm sure some teenagers have about looking at pornography and for whatever reason feeling turned on by it. I appreciated your honesty and the complexity of this.
Yeah. Whenever a kid asks me a question, I want to find out what are all the sub questions that are in there. You know, so first there was an assumption that everybody's turned on by porn. So I want to challenge that. That may not necessarily be true. And then the idea that, you know, watching porn is not a universal experience, that depending upon what you're watching, you may be having very different reactions or seeing very different, getting very different information. You know, being turned on is natural and there's nothing wrong with that, but is what you're watching something that fits your value system? Is it making you feel better about yourself? Is it helping you understand what kind of relationship you want and don't want and interactions you want and don't want? Teenagers have accused me of kind of ruining sex because I asked them to make so many critical judgments about it. But I think that's what we have to do to be healthy.
Let me read some comments. A tweet, begin as soon as kids are talking. Begin by teaching privacy, by asking a child if they need help with dressing, et cetera, expecting an answer. Yes, you're nodding your head.
Absolutely. I think privacy is a great conversation to have with little kids.
An email from Becca. I attended an evangelical school in Newtown Square where we were taught from a textbook was based on the literal biblical teachings as well as a purity culture. Thankfully, my mother is a plain-spoken nurse who set me straight on sex and has always taught me to advocate for myself and my needs. Thanks, Mom. You want to respond to that?
Sure. Actually, I have a theology degree. That's my undergraduate degree. And I spent a lot of my early career talking about how we can reconcile sexuality and spirituality. And I think often people think they are natural adversaries, but they really can speak to each other in beautiful ways. Different religious traditions bring us very different attitudes and views about sex. And what I always encourage people to do is to, you know, not be afraid to ask questions about where does that tradition come from? What is it based on? Has it been a tradition all the way, or were there changes? So sort of, again, doing some digging, knowing your history, and then ultimately asking yourself, does that speak truth to you in your heart? Is that the God that you believe in? And do you think that's what God really wants for you if you believe in God? But I don't think they have to be natural adversaries.
I'm Artie Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let's talk a little bit about abstinence. Mm-hmm. And certainly some schools teach abstinence only or abstinence as part of a larger curriculum. What's your view on abstinence? Do you have a position on abstinence?
Sure I do. Abstinence, I think, can be a really healthy and wonderful choice for people. The term abstinence is pretty loaded today. And so I use a phrase, setting sexual limits, instead. So I ask kids to always think about what are their limits when they're moving into, you know, what are their limits for a hookup? What are their limits with a sweetheart? What are their limits based upon their age? I tell my ninth graders that, from my experience, I don't think most ninth graders are ready for genital sexual activity. I don't think you should be involved.
You say that out loud.
I do. I say it out loud. But what I do say is I think ninth grade is a great year to perfect your kissing skills, because I think kissing is a really undervalued experience that can bring us intimacy and pleasure and passion and connection. And I don't think kissing is a gateway drug to more serious sexual interactions. So I think, you know, talking about what are the limits and why would a kid limit themselves? Because it's much better if a kid applies a limit to themselves than if I impose a limit on them. I can say what I think. Kids can agree or disagree with that.
Well, because I think some of the sex education, especially ones that it's really abstinence only, basically says children can't be, or kids, teenagers cannot be trusted to make decisions in their own best interest. And maybe with the kind of country that we live in, maybe there is some truth to that. But again, your thoughts.
My thought is that that's disrespectful to teenagers. I've met so many teenagers over my career. And have I met teenagers that make mistakes? Absolutely. But I've met so many teenagers, of course, I've met so many teenagers who have initiated their own sexual activity on the basis of conversation and deliberate consideration and really caring for their partner and making sure that the people involved are equally as valued and have equal access to pleasure and have talked about consequences. I'd wish that if an adult told me that that's how they were moving into a sexual encounter, I would give them lots of praise. And I think kids can do that with the right help.
Here's a comment from Rick. He says, when I was working with my teenage daughters, I always emphasized communication. Is it different fathers talking to daughters, mothers talking to sons? Does that matter, do you think?
I think it does. And I think the supposition is that moms talk to daughters and dads talk to sons. But the reality is most of the kids that we're raising are going to be heterosexual. And so they're going to have to talk to the other gender. So if daughter can't talk to father and mother can't talk to son, how are we setting them up to have conversations with a sweetheart who might be of that gender? So I really do think everybody should be talking to everybody. And naturally, kids will gravitate to one parent or another. That's fine. But everybody has to try. Everybody is invited into that conversation.
Well, and I would assume that not requires, but that would hope that the parents then are talking to each other.
Sure.
Which may not be happening.
Sure. I mean, you know, one of my fundamental values is that parents are the primary sexuality educators of their kids, that my job is to assist them. And in the same way that parents allow experts in math to teach their kids math, but they're also the primary math educators of their kids, I'm a sexuality educator. They do the work at home. I continue the work at school. We work together in partnership. And parents at my school know that they can call on me for resources, that they can come into my classroom if they want, that they can always that I work for them as much as I work for their kids. And I think every sexuality educator who works with kids should know that.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about comprehensive sexuality education with Al Vernacchio. We have much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Al Vernacchio. He's been a human sexuality educator for some 25 years. He teaches students in grades, actually nursery school through 12 at Friends Central School in Wynwood, Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia. And he wrote a book a couple of years ago for parents, actually, called For Goodness Sex. And you can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Many ways to join our conversation. Let me play some clips edited together. This is from a 1942 Department of Defense training film warning soldiers about contracting VD.
You're the guy who said gonorrhea was no worse than a cold. Well, I'll bet you never had a cold that felt just like that, did you?
No. But gee, Doc, I'm only human. It's a biological urge.
We didn't say it was criminal. We just said if you did, to protect yourself. You were taught to pull in your rear when bullets were flying over you, weren't you?
Sure, Doc, but...
Then why the hell expose your front?
I must have got it on a toilet seat, Doc.
Now that's a hell of a place to take a girl. And you, did you use a rubber?
No, Doc. She said she was married.
So have we made progress, Al Vernacchio?
We've made some progress from 1942. We certainly have, and I'm thankful for that. But a lot of our conversations about sexually transmitted infections still ring that way.
I do think that we live in a country that is both has a kind of puritanical strain to it, but also has this sexually provocative strain to it. Those are, you know, the kind of two poles of sexuality. And somehow we live between these poles. And I think maybe creates a kind of confusion that I think many people feel.
Absolutely. My friend Jean Marie says that Americans are sexually repressed to the point of being sexually obsessed, which I think is a great way to phrase it, because we have this puritanical background that says nice people don't talk about, think about, do sexual things, but you can't sell toothpaste without using sex. So we're constantly bombarded with these mixed messages, and kids can be very confused by that. So they need somebody to help them navigate that. And that's one of my primary jobs in the classroom.
Do you think there are other countries that do a better job? Have you looked at other countries, for instance?
Oh, there are. If you look at some of the sexuality education happening in places like the Netherlands or even just in Europe, they're so much better. They have far fewer rates of teenage pregnancy, of sexual assault, of abortions. And that's because sexuality is much more naturally a topic of conversation in schools, between parents and kids. Government has a role to play in promoting healthy sexuality, safer sexual activity. So, yeah, there's a lot of good models that we can use, but they bump up against a lot of our earlier values. And, you know, we're a very pluralistic country, and we have to accommodate lots of different views about sexuality.
I was reading some surveys or some research that it looks like, at least talking about ninth graders, that more teenagers are waiting to have sex compared to the past, and that pregnancy rates among teenagers in America is down as well. Is that true, first of all?
That's absolutely true. The research is really good in telling us that. And part of that is because of better comprehensive sexuality education. Part of that is because of pornography, quite honestly, that's giving kids an outlet that they might not have had before for their sexual frustrations or energies. So there's a lot of reasons for that. But it's good news to know that we have fewer teen pregnancies.
Yeah. How do you talk to teenagers about masturbation?
Well, they cringe when I, as of course they would. But, you know, that it's a totally natural, normal thing. And it's normal if you do it, and it's normal if you don't. And, you know, one of the things, I think people, when they hear that I'm a sexuality educator, they think that what I do is just tell kids that sex is awesome. And, you know, the important thing is that I have to make the kid who is making decisions not to masturbate, not to be sexually active, feel just as normal, healthy, and whole as the kid who might be making the choice to do those things. So, you know, hedonism is not healthy. I'm really clear about that with my kids. If somebody would rather stay home and masturbate than go out with their friends on the weekend, I think that might be a problem that they should look at. But as a way to get to know your body, as a way to relieve tension, as an outlet for sexual feelings, we know that it can be a tool that can help. You know, it's not for every kid, it's not for every time and season, but yeah, it's just one more thing we can talk about.
You talk about pleasure.
Oh,
I mean, you have to
yeah,
talk about pleasure
sure.
if you're going to talk about sex.
Huh? Yes, I mean, because ideally, sex should be about pleasure, and for so many young people, it's not. And especially for so many young women, you know, the number of young girls who ask me questions about, you know, how much it's going to hurt the first time they have intercourse because they assume it's going to. And when I say things like, it doesn't have to hurt.
It doesn't have to be intercourse.
Right, it doesn't have to be intercourse either, exactly. And that there are things we can do, you know, a sensitive partner, a conversation, knowing your body. There are so many things that help make that pleasurable. And lastly, that if when two people come together for a sexual encounter, if they're not as equally interested in each other's pleasure, then it's not going to be a good encounter.
Let me read a comment from Frank. You're going to blush, but I'm going to read it anyway. I have relatives that Mr. Vernacchio has taught. They are some of the most balanced young people I've ever met. I'm sorry there wasn't a Mr. Vernacchio in my years at school. So you can blush on the radio. No one will see you. Let me get some callers in. Looks like we've got sure. Kate from Malvern joining us on Radio Times. Kate, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have twin daughters, one who is a trans male now and one who is bisexual. So we have learned a lot about the gender identity continuum as well as the sexual continuum. However, we are also very involved in the Quaker community out where we live. So my children have received a great deal of respect and acceptance. My fear, however, when we leave this community as they get older, what kind of reception they're going to get from the rest of the world. Already when we leave our community and our area, my children get a lot of looks, a lot of stares, sneers. And I wanted to know if you had any discussions with your students about gender identity and what is it you say to your students about gender identity?
It's a great question,
sure.
Kate. Yes,
absolutely.
Thanks for calling it. Go ahead.
So, Kate, first of all, congratulations for raising two amazing kids. Great job. that you've done that they feel so comfortable to be themselves. I think kids who grow up in homes where their parents love and accept them and can talk about these things, I think kids who have good early experiences have a lot of resiliency. It doesn't mean they're not going to face prejudice and discrimination. Unfortunately, they probably are when they go out into the world. But helping your kids know that there's nothing wrong with them, that they are being their authentic selves, that's the best they can be, and that other people react from misunderstanding or from prejudice or from other things. To your question, yes, I talk about gender identity and gender expression in my class. We spend lots of time talking about all of that, the transgender experience, being bisexual, being gender fluid. Kids are much more at ease today with all of the great variety. And I think the good news is that as your kids grow up, they're going to be growing up with young people who also are generally more at ease with this. I think we're moving in a good direction in our society. There's no magic to this, Kate. It's really about building up their resilience and building up their own self-esteem so that when they meet prejudice, they think, oh, I feel really bad for that person, I feel really bad for me.
Such a good point. Kate, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation talking about comprehensive sexuality education with our guest, Al Vernacchio. You have a section in here about body rating exercise,
yes.
And I think everyone should fill this out, not just young people, not just students. How much do you think the fact that, largely speaking, most people don't think that their body is beautiful or their
right.
parts of their body that they wish were different, how much does that affect sexuality?
Oh, huge. We know that poor body image can lead to avoidance of sexual activity, can lead to dysfunction in relationships. And we also, with my kids, have to say, you're not going to feel good about your body every minute of the day. So that's not the goal. You know, the goal is not to feel like you're the greatest thing since sliced bread on the planet. The goal is to know that your body is yours, that it's what you have to work with, to love what you have, and to resist the efforts that we get all the time from people who tell us that we're not something enough, thin enough, blonde enough, fair-skinned enough, whatever. And kids don't know that so often, media targets us to make us feel bad about our bodies because then we'll buy something to try to make it better. And when you inform kids about that and have conversations about that, their eyes get really wide and they think, oh, maybe there isn't anything wrong with me. But most of us have some hang-ups about our bodies. How can we not in a society that judges us so harshly? So again, that's why that authenticity is so important, and knowing that where I'm starting out from is exactly who I'm supposed to be.
You were talking earlier about how sexuality lives within this context, this larger
yeah.
political context, which of course leads inevitably to a discussion about the hearing last week before the Senate Judiciary
sure.
Committee with Kavanaugh and Blasey Ford, the two narratives, the response to the narratives, the language that was used, the high school yearbooks, a person describing what they experienced as some kind of trauma. As someone who deals with kids, what were your thoughts?
Yeah,
what were you thinking about? What were they thinking about?
There's years of material that you could get just from the last few weeks we've had. So noticing the way that our society judges men and women when they talk about their experiences, noticing the emotional range that we're allowed to display, noticing – and, you know, we're not – at no point are we getting into a political discussion here. We're just looking at things like decisions we make when we're 17 and what leads us to make them and, you know, who can put a quote in a yearbook and that's a little racy or a little suggestive and who might get judged for that. So I hope that parents were talking to their kids during the last few weeks, not necessarily about the political piece, although they can if they want to, but more about the opportunities to talk about the way our society looks at gender and looks at sex and looks at sexual assault and the whole, you know, believe women movement and the false reports, right? So maybe there are 2% false reporting, but that means there are 98% that are not false. And making sure we look at all of those avenues, that's ripe for conversation. Kids are hungry for those kind of conversations.
I'm curious because I'm sure while you teach in the class, there are students who will come up to you to talk to you privately. Are there students who have shared incidents of sexual assault, for instance?
There have been. And that's, you know, when I'm most honored is when a kid discloses that to me. Often kids disclose to me long after the experience happened. They're not currently in crisis because as a mandatory reporter, I have obligations around that. And kids know that. And I've talked to kids a lot about getting help, getting into therapy, how important that is. And kids aren't always ready to hear that.
Yeah.
But I've heard from kids years later who said, I remembered that, and I got into therapy, and my life is so much better, and I'm so thankful that I could talk to you back then.
That's Al Vernacchio, and I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Jane actually called us from Newcastle, Delaware. She says, no one seems to have brought up the fact that intercourse is about love. What do you think about that?
Intercourse is about love, absolutely. And it's about pleasure, and it's about connection. It's about a lot of things. And certainly, I want for my students that they have relationships that are loving and intimate and pleasurable and communicative, and knowing that intercourse is one venue for that. But, you know, I've met too many kids who told me that the reason they had intercourse was they didn't know how else to express love or affection. So part of what we have to do is give kids lots of other options for showing intimacy. You know, I always tell kids, if you want to be really intimate with somebody, take a nap with them.
Oh.
That can be so much more intimate than having sex with them.
This may be too intimate a question for you, but have your students taught you something about sex and sexuality?
Always. I think any good teacher learns as much from their students. I have learned how to be much more flexible in my acceptance of lots of different ways that kids identify themselves. I have become much more empathetic. You know, I had my own struggles as a young person, but to be in the presence of young people who can express their joys and their fears can't help but make my heart grow, you know, many, many sizes, and it has over the years. And kids have taught me that I'm not always right. And that's humbling, but that's really important. And I'm thankful for those. But mostly kids have told me that I should keep talking because the more we talk, the better everything is.
Anything shock you?
I'm pretty unshockable at this point, I think. I've been doing this a long time.
And this was something, did you think when you were 18-year-old yourself, oh, I'm going to grow up and be a comprehensive sexuality educator?
No, I knew I wanted to be a teacher when I was 18, but I thought I was going to be a religion teacher. And then I found this path, and it's the direction my life took, and I'm very thankful for it. I wouldn't want to do anything else with my life.
Can you teach sexuality without religion?
You can't.
Do they
teach
go together?
You can't teach sexuality without values. And some of those values are religious values and some of them aren't. But there's no hindrance to teaching sexuality in a religious context.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Al Vernacchio, thank you so much for coming in and joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. We have been talking about pleasure and sexuality with our guest, Al Vernacchio. His book, written largely for parents, is For Goodness Sex, came out a couple of years ago. And he's a comprehensive sexuality educator at Friends Central School, which is just outside of Philadelphia. He also happens to be chair of the English department at Friends Central as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for those questions, and thanks for joining us.